Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangihau Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Taloha ni, no ia e Māori, ka salerie. And good morning, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. On the show today, a nation mourns the loss of one half of conjoined twins from PNG.
7 hours into the surgery, Tom was separated from Sawong, and as expected, he passed on soon after.
There's bans set in place for three Tongan rugby league officials. There's a first of its kind tool to track deep sea mining activities.
The idea is to give everybody that transparent insight of what folks are planning out there in our global ocean and to have the power to weigh in to say, you know, is this something that we actually want to see start?
And new funding deal for rugby union in the Pacific is actually being held up by Samoa's Prime Minister. But why?
A bit of politics here as well. Doesn't help, but I'm sure they can put aside their political rivalry for the best of the country.
All that and more. But before we start, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dupol, and I say me taki ma'ata. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Papua New Guinea is in mourning with the sad news that one of the country's conjoined twins has passed away. Sawong and Tom captured the nation's attention when they were born connected at the abdomen exactly 2 months ago. They were flown to Port Moresby for treatment. Then last week, they travelled onwards to Sydney for urgent surgery. Tragically, Tom passed away on Sunday following 7 hours of surgery, and his brother Sawong is recovering and is in a critical but stable condition. Papua New Guineans have paid tribute to Tom, with Prime Minister James Marape saying his government is committed to paying the medical bills for the twins.
Well, I want to thank Australia government also, those who took care of the twins in the transportation down hospitals here in Australia. Unfortunately, one could not survive the operation. Looking at taking care of the surviving twin, as a government, gave assurance that the medical bills will be picked up in terms of the full total bills. And I want to say thank you to the Australian government. Based on our assurance, they're able to facilitate the quick transfer to hospital. So to the parents, we absolutely did our best.
Meanwhile, pilot Jürgen Rue, who flew the twins from Morobe province to Port Moresby, says the surviving twin, Sawong, is in an induced coma but is recovering.
7 hours into the surgery, Tom was separated from Sawong, and as expected, he passed on soon after. And then it took another 5 hours to put Sawong back together. So it was a total. The team was totally on the ground for about 12 hours.
How are the parents doing? We understand that you're with them there, and we just want to check in with them. How are they going?
For the parents, it has been a roller coaster. And obviously, since Tom passed on and they were given the opportunity to hold him for all these days now, there's been a roller coaster up and down. And the parents' view was from the very beginning, like, if we remain in Papua New Guinea, in Port Moresby, there is absolutely no hope for the twins to survive. If Tom passes on attached to Sawong, then it would have been a very awful death for Tom. And it would have been an awful death for the parents to see. The parents just wanted to do something. They want to make sure something is done to try. Just try. It doesn't matter of the outcome. And they would have accepted any outcome. And then I think the Sydney team came up about 10 days ago to Port Moresby to have a look at the twins and to see, come up with a plan. And yes, they confirmed they are able to be separated. And so we've come down here basically when the situation deteriorates a little bit with Tom.
Can you just briefly tell us what is Sawong's condition like right now?
I think the condition is called critical and stable. Obviously, with the emergency separation, they didn't have time to stretch or grow any skin to close up Sawong. In normal circumstances, they would wait for a month or two, have procedures to stretch the skin for skin to be available to close. You know, Sawong's stomach will need some time to be fully closed. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why it is considered critical. A lot of the vital signs of Sawong have improved from yesterday to today, so we know he's heading uphill.
How long will Sawong remain in hospital for?
That's difficult to say. It will be probably more than a month to many months. Even for him to come out of the induced coma that he's in now, it will take more than a week to many weeks. Obviously, they can't wake him up now. He is on treatment for his the pain he would have by now. So he can't be woken up because of the pain he would be in. So his stitches have to heal. He had a lot of procedures done, and whatever his stitches they gave him have to heal before he can wake up. But he is going. All the signs are he is improving as much as he could improve. He's not going. He's not level, and he's not going downhill. But he's improving.
And that is family spokesperson Jürgen Ruh, and he was speaking there to ABC's Henry Swartz. Now, three Tonga Rugby League officials have been banned from the NRL for 2 years over the injury of Melbourne Storm second row Elias Sakatoa. The banned officials include the head doctor, assistant doctor and head trainer. Katoa underwent brain surgery after collapsing on the sidelines of last month's Pacific Championships game between Tonga and New Zealand. Katoa had been waived to play in the game despite suffering a severe concussion prior to kickoff. The incident prompted outrage among many rugby league elites, such as former Kiwi Sean Johnson, who had witnessed the pre-game concussion.
I do not know how Eli Katoa was actually even allowed to take the field. All I thought straight away when I saw that was like, okay, if that happened in a game, or if that happened at training during the week, he's done. Like, it's done.
And the CEO of the Tonga Rugby League, Lord Whakawhonua, has released this statement.
We acknowledge receipt of the breach notices from the NRL this evening. The management and medical staff of Tonga Rugby League have fully cooperated with the NRL throughout the investigation. As the medical staff have now been issued breach notices, they will respond within the designated time frame. We are committed to respecting this process and refrain from any actions that may prejudice its outcome prior to its conclusion.
And that was Lord Whakawhonua, the CEO of the Tonga Rugby League.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Raiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. There's a first-of-its-kind tool that'll track deep-sea mining activities that has been launched by an American university. The Deep Sea Mining Watch portal is free and available for anyone to access, allowing users to follow the activity of mining vessel movements and companies interested in mining the seabed. Dr. Douglas McCauley is the director of the laboratory at the University of California, the institution behind the portal. An expert in ocean ecosystems, he told Lucy Cooper the motivation for creating the tool was greater transparency in the novel industry.
If there were a mine to pop up in your backyard on land, you can bet that you would have all kinds of access to data, to maps, to public discussions about whether or not you want that mine in your backyard, and if it's coming to town, you would have that data and that transparency of information about a new mine that's opening. So you can weigh in and decide and contribute to whether or not that's something you want to happen. But in the oceans, things are different. We do have the same backyard. It just happens to be a lot bluer, a lot bigger, a lot further afield. But there are groups that are planning these mines in our oceans. So the idea with Deep Sea Mining Watch is to give everyone the same kind of transparent access to where exactly are these mines being considered. What countries are driving this activity? What companies are actually are pushing forward and doing some of this exploration that they hope will lead to mining? So everyone has equal access to that data.
So if I was to, I suppose, log on to the Deep Sea Mining Watch portal, and what exactly is it telling me, and what does it look like?
Seabed mining is being planned in almost every one of our oceans. But what you can do when you jump onto the website and onto the map is you can start to click through to see where there are specific mining vessels operating in specific parts of the ocean. You can see exactly, you'll see the outlines, polygons on a map of which mining claim areas have already been issued for exploration and which parts of the ocean, which countries are leading this charge, this, you know, some folks call it a new gold rush in the oceans. So all of that information is now at your fingertips, just a few clicks away in this new map.
Why has it been developed? What's the motivation there?
The idea is to give everybody that transparent insight of what folks are planning out there in our global ocean, and to have the power to weigh in to say, you know, is this something that we actually want to see start? And get engaged in the conversation with some actual information that allows them to have more power when they're sitting around there at the table.
And I suppose on that topic of transparency, is this coming from a pro-environment, anti-mining stance, the creation of this portal?
No, not at all. I mean, we're scientists that think that data is for everybody. So when you jump on the portal, what you really get is just an equitable view of what's happening out there. And it's for you to ingest that insight, you know, whether you're somebody from, you know, Pacific Island community, or whether you're somebody from maritime shipping or industrial fishing. We expect that people are going to use that data for all kinds of different to protect their values and interests in these ocean spaces. And that's important to us. What our primary goal is not to be advocates for what the future of the ocean should be or the future of what seabed mining should be, but just to make sure that everyone has the same view as the mining industry about what's being planned in this space and can engage in the conversations for what they want their ocean to be like. So that's what you get, is just the facts, if you will, as to where, when, why, and whom are getting involved in seabed mining if you jump onto the map.
What are the hopes for this portal? Is there potential for expansion, or, you know, more detailed information to be added into it?
Definitely. So the information you get right now, we hope and think, is helpful. So you can drill down and see exactly where a particular seabed mining exploration vessel is operating. You can see, you know, where it's taking its product, where it's planning to take whatever it's mined in these prospecting trials, and where it's carrying it for refining. You can see and get connected by clicking in on a vessel, some history of information about with the vessel, and who and what countries and what investors are connected to that vessel. Again, more and more information the further you go in the tool. But there's a great deal of opportunity for growth. You can imagine, for example, a future, if seabed mining were to happen, then there's the opportunity, for example, to add in satellite data to monitor whether there are spills of pollution from these mining operations at sea. So there's a great deal of room to grow, depending on where things go, nations and what the world thinks of what the future of this new industrial activity in the ocean ought to become.
And that's Dr. Douglas McCauley, a professor at the University of California, speaking with Lucy Cooper.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, the World Bank is well known for providing financing to Pacific governments, but lesser known is its role in the education sector in the region. This involves building the capacity of teachers in the region and the materials they use to educate young people in the region. Whenau Whenua sat down with Sean Powers, Senior Education Economist at the World Bank.
The World Bank really does a combination of things, partly, as you might guess from the bank terminology, we provide financing to countries through government systems for different types of programming in education, health, infrastructure, across the whole spectrum of development. But we also consider ourselves a knowledge bank. So a lot of what we do is also advisory support and analytical work, again, working in partnership with countries, but helping them to understand their development challenges and design solutions to address those areas of greatest need.
Could you give some specific examples of some of the work?
Sure. So over the last 3 years, we've had a program called ASPIRE, which stands for Advisory Support for the Pacific Island Region in Education. We love acronyms at the World Bank. And this is made possible through funding support from Australia through the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and a couple of other multi-donor trust funds within the World Bank. But it has a strong focus on teachers. So we work with several Pacific Island countries to try to strengthen the teaching profession with the goal, of course, of improving children's learning outcomes, because that we think is the surest way to improve their opportunities over the long run in adulthood as workers, as citizens, as family members, as community leaders. Under the ASPIRE program, we've worked on several initiatives. One is classroom observation, so helping countries develop and customize tools to look at how teachers are teaching in the classroom. What are the strengths? What are the areas that need to be improved? Another area is content knowledge for teaching, so looking at how well teachers have mastered the material that their students are expected to learn, and then can they translate that content knowledge into effective teaching? And then we've also done studies on teacher professional development. So what kind of training and support is provided to teachers in these countries?
What are the biggest challenges you've observed or that you've noticed in Pacific Island countries in terms of the education?
And the area where teachers seem to struggle the most is on promoting students' social and emotional skills. So that includes things like autonomy, giving students choices in the classroom, promoting collaboration between students. One of the things we found in our studies on teacher professional development is, especially when you get into the remote outlying islands, the rural areas of countries like Fiji, it's actually very difficult to give teachers consistent support. And very often in those cases, the teachers who are in those communities may have less preparation. In many cases, they may be volunteers, especially at the early childhood level, with a minimum of training. So it's really critical to provide support to them, but that's also the most difficult in the sense of isolation, the high cost of delivering training. We've been working with countries to develop different strategies to address some of these challenges. So in Kiribati, for example, our team looked at the results of the classroom observation study in early childhood, helped the government, including the Ministry of Education and the Teachers College, design a professional development package for teachers, and then brought a group of island-based teacher coaches from 17 different islands across the country. And Kiribati, if you know Kiribati, it covers a vast area in the Pacific Ocean. So bringing them together in one place, and then they returned to their islands and they were able to deliver that training to the teachers. Another factor that has a lot of promise, I think, in this area is technology. So teachers are very adept at using social media, at using mobile technology. So that's another area where we encourage teachers to collaborate with each other and to develop communities of practice where they can interact and support each other, even over very great physical distances.
And that was Sean Powers, a senior education economist at the World Bank. Mano tamae bombongini, you're tuning into Pacific Beat, and I'm your host, Agitha Bowl. This morning, we are heading around the region to get the latest headlines, and that's brought to you by our producer, Whenau Whenua, who's in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, Whewhewhake.
So, Agi, I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming through this morning, Whenau. We have got a couple of stories here. First, we start off in Fiji, where the former finance minister, Biman Prasad, has actually appeared at the Suva Magistrates Court. What's the latest here?
Yes, according to Fiji Village and Fiji Sun, Mr. Prasad attended court where he faces charges of failing to comply with statutory disclosure requirements under Fiji's Political Parties Act 2013. He's been charged with providing false information by the Fiji Anti-Corruption Agency. Prasad has pleaded not guilty to two charges laid against him. Wow. So the specific charges are basically corruption. It'd be interesting to see how this case unfolds. He lost his cabinet position as a result of this, but continues as a member of parliament.
Wow. Okay, well, we head to Vanuatu now because the government has cancelled more than 30 diplomatic passports. What's that?
Yes, this is according to Vanuatu Daily Post. Vanuatu's Ministry of Internal Affairs has cancelled more than 30 diplomatic passports. According to the Minister of Internal Affairs, Andrew Napoa, it's a move to restore integrity in Vanuatu's diplomatic passport system. As you know, Vanuatu has received widespread criticism over its passport system, the golden, quote, golden passport system. A lot of controversy regarding that. And he says this year's administrative cleanup forms part of a broader initiative to safeguard the legitimacy of travel documents issued by the state.
Oh, that's something I think we'll definitely keep our eyes and ears on to update our listeners. We head to sports, though, now. News and soccer. What's happening here?
Yes, a lot of excitement across Oceania region. New Zealand, their match schedule for the FIFA World Cup next year has been unveiled. Australia is participating in the World Cup as well.
Nice.
Both countries representing Oceania. New Zealand, they're grouped alongside Belgium, Egypt, and Iran. Tough pool. And they'll play two of their games in Vancouver and Canada, one in Los Angeles, and they'll start against Iran in Los Angeles. The final two games, in Vancouver against Egypt and Iran. Australia, they have a tough pool as well. It's going to be exciting World Cup.
Absolutely. I mean, are you a fan yourself?
Oh, well, I love watching the World Cup. A lot of the vibe is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's great to see two teams from Oceania the Soccer World Cup.
And how do you think they'll go?
Well, in the last time New Zealand played in a World Cup, they did very well. They drew with Italy.
Mm.
They didn't lose any of their games. They drew in all of their games. It was a surprising outcome. Hopefully they can do the same next year.
Yeah. Well, we will be looking forward to that World Cup fever next year, 2026. But for now, always, thank you very much for bringing us our headlines here on Pacific Beat. Now, if you're just joining us, I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. This is Pacific Beat, bringing you the latest in news from across the region. Just a quick recap of today's show so far. Tragedy is one of the conjoined twins passes away, but PNG government say they'll foot the medical bill. There's bans set in place for three Tongan Rugby League officials after player Eliasakato's head injury. And we shared about the first of its kind tool to track deep sea mining activities. Still to come though, your headlines from around the region, well, which we have just done. Your new funding deal for rugby union in the Pacific is being held up by Samoa's Prime Minister, but why? Well, we'll find out about that very shortly here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Faftaidile Lava, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, a new Australian government funding deal for rugby union in the Pacific is being held up by Samoa's new Prime Minister, Lauli Alemaliato-Schmidt. But the question is why? Fiji and Tonga have already signed off on the package worth $150 million, but Lauli is stalling amid suggestions that he wants a shake-up of the Lakapi Samoa board that would include the removal of the chairman and his arch-political rival, Tuila Epa Sa'ilele Malielenga Oi. Now, as Richard Hewitt reports, the chief executive of Tonga Rugby is urging the two men to put their political differences aside for the good of all three Pacific unions.
Money is in short supply at the Tongan Rugby Union, so the prospect of sharing in $150 million from Canberra is an exciting one for the TRU's CEO, Aisia Aholele.
Pretty much over the moon that the Australian government is considering giving the green light to the proposal for us, Fiji and Samoa, to be part of bigger competitions, especially in Australia. The Moana Pacifica pathway isn't really going to plan, and this is sort of a backup plan for us that will help us tremendously with giving our players better competition to grow their game. For us, it's a godsend.
What the new money would do is pave the way for Tonga, Fiji and Samoa to enter teams into Super Rugby Oz. That's the third-tier competition, which kicked off for the first time this year with development teams from the four Australian Super Rugby Pacific franchises involved to begin with. Tonga and Samoa in particular are enthusiastic about the idea because they believe not enough of their young players are getting a chance at Moana Pacifica. Lakapi Samoa's chief executive, Douglas Nau Chun, is hopeful, as is his opposite number in Tonga, that money from World Rugby that has been going to Moana will be funneled back to them now.
We have fundings lining up, and we're in talks now with the Australian Rugby Union, World Rugby, in securing those funds.
That said, therefore, what would be the nature of a Samoan side that would compete in Super Rugby Oz?
Definitely, there will be the development teams. It allows us the opportunity to bring the expertise from Australia and build the pathways for our locals here and keep our players on island.
I just got told that World Rugby probably won't be funding Moana Pacifica, but questions were put to World Rugby whether that money will come to Samoa and Tonga. When and how much, we don't really know. But they said that it will come back to our unions.
Whatever happens to that money is not dependent upon politicians' signatures, but the money being offered by Australia is very much a government-to-government matter.
As far as sealing this deal is concerned, my understanding is that Fiji and Tonga, their respective governments have signed off, but that's not the case in Samoa. I don't know whether you're in a position to tell me why or not, because I gather it could be quite sensitive.
Well, we're meeting the Prime Minister, and we'll have a sit down with him, and he already gave his full support. It's just us getting his signature that we're after.
I believe we may be at risk here of sport and politics colliding. Would that be right?
I can't comment on that. We want to make sure that we can secure this funding from Australian government and work closely with Australian Rugby Union in implementing what we propose.
But the word on the grapevine is that Prime Minister Lauli has effectively frozen funding for Lakapi Samoa in an effort to remove all politicians from the union's board, but in particular the chairman, his political rival, Tuila Epa, who has occupied that post for decades. But as he indicated to local journalists during Manu Samoa's bumpy qualifying ride to the 2027 World Cup, standing down is not on the opposition leader's agenda.
Will we be seeing any changes along the board? Will they be stepping down in the future?
Of what?
From the board?
Will that improve the play? That is a very stupid question. I am not playing there. What is important is the money that must be provided, and we haven't got enough money. That comes from the government.
Aisia Aholele, for one, will be praying that Lakapi Samoa can persuade their Prime Minister to put pen to paper.
You hear stories just like yourself about what's happening in Samoa, but what I know is that rugby is in everybody's hearts in Samoa. I think it's just them to sort out their connections and who will guide their union through this program and this gift.
But also, I think political rivalry, and my understanding is that maybe what's holding things up here, that the new Prime Minister essentially wants the old Prime Minister off the board.
Yeah, I think a bit of politics here as well. It doesn't help, but I'm sure they can put aside their political rivalry for the best of the country.
However, were Lauli to succeed in his apparent mission to remove Tuila Epa, it's likely there would be a collective sigh of relief at Lakapi's Samoa. More than once during the Manu's difficult journey to the next World Cup, the chairman threatened to sack coaches and officials he blamed for the team's struggles. And CEO Douglas Nauchun was very much in the firing line.
If Belgium have overcome us in Dubai, probably you'll be talking to a new CEO now. That match was very important to us because it determines the future of our rugby on island.
20 seconds to go. All they need to do is win this line out and get the ball off this field. Clock is through the 80.
Nine.
There's the siren for full time. They win the ball at the front of the line out. Nico Jones has it, turning up his Papali'i. He puts it over the sideline, and that is full time. Samoa are off to a 10th Rugby World Cup.
We were tasked by the board to deliver. Luckily, we did in the end. So now we have another opportunity as a team to sit down, plan, and make sure we take the lessons learned from this year's performance.
And that task will be made easier if Lakapi Samoa can lay their hands on the Australian government money that is on the table. And their neighbours in Tonga and Fiji will be very grateful too. But right now, it would appear the matter rests in the hands of just one man.
And that's Richard Ewart reporting there. And we will keep you posted on the outcome of what looks like an all-important meeting between Lakapi Samoa and Prime Minister Lauli. Now, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister says Australia will create a special new NRL visa access as PNG prepares to join the rugby league competition in 2028. James Manape says the visa is just one of the new initiatives that will come into place as the PNG chiefs enter the NRL. Mr. Manape says country's economy will benefit with up to 3,000 visitors entering the country each week to watch rugby league.
NRL is a game changer for us. Our core focus in the team is to have a national unity strategy. It must unite our country. Every week, we gravitate towards one focal point. But in the process, the team will has an impact to the economy. I think Deloitte has made a study that it's a 1% hit to the GDP. So that's the value of NRL coming in. You look at 3,000 to 4,000 visitors every week when a visiting team is played here. They're coming up. So we're working with other airlines companies in Australia, including Air New Guinea and PNG Air, to see how best we could have regular more flights out of Cairns and Brisbane to uplift supports coming in or take our supports going down. So there'll be a fireside conversation with Peter Volandis, as well as he's making a presentation in the conference himself on NRL and what's required. This year, we put 100 million aside to assist in the Center of Excellence. Next year, there's another 100 million set aside for Center of Excellence. Our commitment indicating government's seriousness, and those will be reinvested in 2028 in the funds that we're putting for the setup and NRL. So all work, clockwork's happening. I look forward to running on as a water boy in 2028 with my team. Go to Chiefs. We'll be rolling out membership for the Chiefs. So we'll look at those who want to be members for the Chiefs. There'll be special incentives. You member of the Chiefs, and by the way, Australia government, I think they'll be announcing tomorrow also, there's a special category of visa being opened up just for this NRL season. So I think it's a one-year visa, and so it's opening up. So keep a lookout for this. We're working with Australia. We will be also mentioning on the security treaty. The security treaty, the anti-general visa conversations is we looked at.
And that is PNG PM James Marape speaking there at a press conference. An Australian Papua New Guinean artist is being celebrated for his career to date with a touring show across the country. Multidisciplinary artist Yuria Bridgman splits his time between Brisbane, where he is based, and the highlands of PNG, where his family is from. He told Lucy Cooper that his PNG heritage has pushed him to continue as an artist.
Art school was really influential, but not as influential as going home and spending time with my family, my brothers, aunties, sisters, uncles, the whole tribe. And then we started making work together. And, you know, I have a nice studio in West End in Brisbane. But my connection to home back in PNG is the main thing that's kept me interested in art.
Your current exhibition is touring and it's in Townsville at the moment. Tell me a little bit about this exhibition and what exactly it encompasses.
It's a touring show of my survey show that happened at Griffith University Art Museum. So Griffith was the university that I studied at, and that was 15 years ago. So they decided to put on a show, I guess, a sort of the survey show of work that I've done since I graduated, which is a bit of an honor. We published a book as well that's available there as well. And it covers a lot of different stages, I guess, of my journey as an artist. I work in a lot of mediums. So, you know, I began doing a photography degree. That's what I was doing there. And then I moved into sculpture and sometimes, you know, performative works, and then into building structures and then working with my group up in PNG, painting. You know, in the last 10 years, I picked up painting. We work, you know, with the group. We're focused on our shield designs. Well, the show is called You Belong, Me Belong You, which in Pidgin, it's sort of a twist in words, which basically means you belong with me and I belong with you, or we belong together in that sort of a realm of things.
So you were born in Queensland, but really a lot of that art and influence is coming from your family's connections back in PNG. PNG is incredibly diverse between the tribes and the provinces. What particular things out of your family in PNG, you know, is quite distinctive in the art that you create, say, compared to other tribes and regions in PNG?
I'm from the Yuri tribe, so that's in my name as well, Yuri. And we're from the south region of Chimbu province in the highlands, and there's over 900 languages and tribes. In my time as an artist, I've just focused on sort of what I feel belongs to me, you know, and our tribe. I don't go really anywhere else, or, you know, I don't go anywhere unless I'm invited to, if you know what I mean. So we're from a region in the highlands where our history is very much built from history of tribal fighting and conflict. So these are our sort of our main things that we connect to.
You co-founded an artist collective with your family members. Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of that collective?
When I finished art school, I felt a real pull to go back home because I wanted to continue doing art, but I felt that, you know, being in Australia, it's sort of, you know, I don't have a total connection to this place and I need to go and find that. So I started going back with my mum, and I met a lot of these cousins and uncles who I still work with today, and we founded this group together kind of very naturally. There wasn't really an intent. There was a time when I needed to build they said, you know, we want to build you a house. So when you can keep coming back, and we want you to keep coming back. And then they decided to build this grand sort of circular round house. And I was really kind of like, oh, you know, this house has got so much potential. It's such a statement, but what are we going to do with it? And then it just sort of like clicked. It's like, well, we're starting to work together. You know, let's start have what, like when the house was finished, said, I think this is where this is a house that we're going to start making work in and have meetings about it and see what grows from it. It's an important base for our group as artists now, and we make work in there. So it's really kind of been probably the most, you know, important thing that we've done is we need to build this house, build this structure that will promote growth for us, not just when we're talking about making work or making paintings, you know, and sending them to a show, but personal growth.
Join Sose Fomoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
No mai haere mai, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, here's something a little bit different. Now to the deepest jungles of Indonesia, where researchers have located one of the rarest flowers in the world. It's a subspecies of Indonesia's famous giant corpse flower. Those blooms often called the stinking corpse lily because they smell like rotten flesh. This particular variety hasn't been spotted for more than a decade. The Indonesian conservationist who tracked down the bloom hopes it will become a symbol to promote the conservation of its rainforest home. Tim Swanson prepared this report.
Deep in the tropical jungles of West Sumatra, a team of conservationists and rangers are on a quest. They're searching for an extremely rare flower, Indonesia's famous stinking corpse lily, which can grow up to a metre wide and weigh more than 6 kilograms.
This is a nearly impossible mission, since the last time people saw that species and publicised or posted it on social media was in 2011.
Septian Andriki, or Deki as he prefers to be known, is an Indonesian conservationist, and for 13 years he's been hunting for Rafflesia hasselti. Earlier this year, a ranger in remote western Sumatra had stumbled upon the flower buds in the early stages of its life cycle. Now they've trekked a full day through incredibly dense jungle to find it, risking tiger attacks along the way. And after hours of walking, they arrive just in time.
It's okay. We did it. We found it.
Deki was overcome with emotion.
I couldn't hold my feelings any longer. It was an explosion, a mix between joy and sentimentality. Waiting 13 years is a long time, plus a 23-hour trip, taking tiger attack risk, nearly dead phone batteries. I could not say any more and broke down in tears.
Also on the trek was Dr. Chris Thorogood, the Deputy Director of the University of Oxford Botanic Garden. He's been working with Deki for several years.
There are 40 or so species of Rafflesia, the world's largest flowers, but this one is a super rare one. Hardly anyone has seen it. And to my mind, it's the most beautiful. It's kind of like white with these big red spots and then the reverse of that on the petals. It's just crazy.
Finding Rafflesia hasselti was already a big challenge, but timing their trip was even more difficult.
The buds of this flower take several months, up to 9 months actually, to mature. And then when the flower opens, it only actually stays open to him for a few days. So the chances of having this encounter that we did are so unlikely.
And waiting next to the flower in the darkness for more than an hour, in the middle of a well-known Sumatran tiger habitat, Deki, Chris and their guide Iswandi witnessed something incredible.
And so we sat there as dusk came and watched the flower open in front of our very eyes at about the same speed as the moon rises in the sky. So you can't quite see it, but you know it's happening. And by the time we left, it was almost open. And that was just an absolutely magical experience, and one that will remain living in my memory diamond sharp for the rest of my life, I think.
For Deki, this flower symbolises what he's spent his life fighting for. Indonesia's rainforests have suffered greatly from deforestation, a fate he hopes this patch of forest will avoid.
We can do ecotourism with forest, as one of the ideas is to have sustainable tourism. The worst is that they turn this social forest permit into a palm oil plantation, a monoculture plant, or coffee. So ecotourism is a solution for the farmer. Seeing Rafflesia is a very interesting alternative.
Despite the amazing achievement, the trip has generated some controversy. A post about the flower was shared by the University of Oxford, but was met with criticism among some users who were furious that it did not name the Indonesian conservationists and guides involved. The University of Oxford has told the ABC it was delighted to be working with its Indonesian colleagues and that one of its goals is the support of local conservation heroes. This is Tim Swanston reporting for PM.
Time to take a look back at our main story today. Papua New Guineans are mourning the loss of one of the conjoined twins who passed away during separation surgery.
7 hours into the surgery, Tom was separated from Sawong
And as expected, he passed on soon after.
And you can find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Remember, you can check us out on our socials, on Facebook and Instagram. Now, our team will be back at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next is your news, and after that, it is Nija Daily. So until next time, o tō awha atu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.